This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to an infectious disease physician about the CDC's new warning of a fast-spreading, drug-resistant fungus that, for some vulnerable patients, can be fatal. Now, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, known as the IPCC, released a new report last week warning of imminent and severe consequences from rising global temperatures. The report found that the Earth is likely to pass a dangerous temperature threshold and suffer irreversible damage in the next 10 years unless we take more drastic action to combat climate change. But the IPCC has put out at least 36 reports warning about the dangers of climate change going back to 1990, but the U.S. and other countries still haven't taken the kind of major steps that the UN has called for. We're learning more about the types of social, political, and institutional obstacles that stand in the way of more substantial climate action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we haven't seen a stronger fight against climate change? Are there changes you would like to see made? What do you see as the barriers to those changes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Brad Mapes-Martins is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Stevens Point, where he researches climate change, sustainability, and environmental policy. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jeremiah Bohr, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Oshkosh. He studies the institutional and behavioral obstacles to sustainability and climate change. Jeremiah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Jeremiah, let's start with you. Now, you are working, I understand, with a unique data set looking at political polarization and how it affects climate change. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working with and what you're starting to find?
The big project I'm working on right now is I have a large archive of social media posts from members of Congress. Specifically from Twitter. So I have a little under 3 million tweets dating back to 2015 that I've been working with. And I'm interested in a lot of things, but climate change among them. And one of the really striking early findings that I've found so far is that, somewhat on an optimistic note, we're becoming a little bit less polarized in how we talk about climate change by how our political representatives talk about it. It hasn't really translated into how we vote about climate issues yet, but I do find a little bit of optimism that at least the conversation seems to be veering towards a common understanding of the problem at hand.
And Brad, how much has political polarization been a part of the story when it comes to the U.S. Response to climate change?
I don't think it can be understated. I mean, going back for at least 2 decades, climate change has been not just a polarized issue, but in many cases, the most polarized issue when you kind of rank the different ways that partisans feel about public policies. And so it's very kind of positive to hear Dr. Bohr talking about the signs of kind of a little bit of depolarization going on in civic communication.
Jeremiah, one part of the story, since you're looking at a data set that includes members of Congress from the whole country, is, you know, are places feeling more climate change impacts, so they're, you know, behaving one way, whereas places that are so far more insulated are another? Or is this a local, I guess, response or a nationalized response? What are you seeing?
Yeah, that's really interesting because it's actually the parts of the country that are most vulnerable to climate change who have the representatives who talk about it the least. So the conversation is in a lot of ways, it's being driven by representatives of constituents who are relatively speaking least vulnerable to climate change. So there's a lot of interesting patterns in the politics of how we talk about climate change. And so depolarization is one optimistic tone that I would strike, but another, you know, maybe a little bit more worrying tone would be that the places that need to be thinking about it the most simply are not yet.
Brad, one kind of assumption of this conversation is, okay, the U.S. has set targets on climate change at various points. International treaties have set targets for the U.S. and other industrialized countries. How do you evaluate, Brad, how the U.S. performance has stacked up to the various milestones that have been set?
I mean, in comparison to the expectations as they've been laid out in treaties, I think it's hard to be, you know, satisfied with the way that the U.S. has performed insofar as we've frequently kind of undershot our goals. That being said, though, one of the kind of big questions in political science has been the extent to which treaties operate from goals first and then try to work back, you know, and try to establish what nations will do rather than working from what nations can do, politically speaking, and then figure out what the likely targets would be from that.
We are talking to Brad Mapes-Martins, political scientist at UW-Stevens Point, and Jeremiah Bohr, sociologist at UW-Oshkosh, looking at climate change. You know, there's the science out there, another UN report saying the horizon, the time horizon for action on climate change keeps getting shorter if we want to prevent the worst. We're talking about, well, what's keeping us from taking action, what leads to some kinds of action being taken, not others. You can join in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. What do you think stands in the way of more serious climate change action? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeremiah, we've talked about polarization some so far. What do you see as some of the other obstacles for a country like the United States in taking more action on climate change?
You know, with something like climate mitigation, a lot of this has to do with who are going to be the relative winners and losers of the drastic changes that might need to be made. And so I think some of this just comes down to where are the economic benefits going to spread? And I think that feeds into a lot of the polarization, because I think there is a sense that Republican and Democrats, they tend to represent different types of economies in terms of the industries that might be most impacted by aggressive climate mitigation. And so I think to some extent that there is a fear that that a greener economy might leave some behind. And I think that there are some pretty strong partisan patterns to at least where those fears are. And I do think that policymakers seem to be paying attention to that, because the Inflation Reduction Act does seem to be targeting some more red state districts in where some of these greener benefits are going to be geographically located.
Brad, I talked to Jeremiah some about his work on members of Congress. Some of your work focuses really at the local level. What kind of things do you see when it comes to climate action and sustainability when you zoom in on local efforts?
Well, I mean, speaking just within, for instance, Wisconsin, I am generally, you know, find that at the local level, one of the sort of strengths that we have is that young people are energetic about doing something about climate change. And that is one, it's a lot of kind of civic energy that we need to see directed towards it. And hopefully what that means is that we'll see a sustained effort over time, because to sort of, you know, add to what Jeremiah just said, that we have kind of a political system that is kind of limiting the way that we can move forward on climate change, simply because there's so many opportunities for partisans to veto changes. And so we have to have political effort that takes place over a long period of time. And so my local kind of site is still to focus on primarily where we see young people kind of energized, even before they're old enough to vote.
And Brad, you've compared the U.S. With places in Europe and I believe Australia when it comes to these kind of local climate change activism efforts. What compare and contrast for us?
Well, I mean, in some ways, there's actually some strong similarities between places like Australia and the United States in the way that the issue of climate change became polarized. But one thing that we've seen, particularly in parts of Europe and in the UK, is that there are kind of forums that have allowed for the depolarization of this issue. It was never quite as bad in sort of areas like France or Germany. We never saw that level of polarization, so they didn't have as much to overcome. But at the local level, we've seen an emphasis on dialogue that builds kind of a common sense of, I won't say unity around it, but at least takes away some of the tension that comes out of what Jeremiah pointed out earlier, which is these, at least even the perception of conflicting interests, that one group may be harmed more than another.
We're talking to Brad Mapes-Martins, UW-Stevens Point political scientist, and Jeremiah Bohr, UW-Oshkosh sociologist. We're looking at the obstacles keeping us from doing more to combat climate change. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What barriers do you see preventing more action against climate change? What do you think about members of Congress and how they have tackled the issue? How about at the local level? Do you see some of that youth participation in this issue that Brad was talking about just a few minutes ago? Are you one of those youth participating in efforts against climate change? What are you working toward? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our talk about climate change and why we don't always see a lot of action to fight it, at least not meeting international treaty targets, for example, even as scientists from around the world warn of dire consequences. Our guests today are UW-Stevens Point political science professor Brad Mapes-Martins and UW-Oshkosh sociology professor Jeremiah Bohr. They both research environmental policy and politics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you'd like to see made to fight climate change? What kind of things do you see in your community, your state, your country that maybe make you feel positive on the issue? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I just want to say that we've known about this for a long time. I'm 72 years old, and I remember when I was in my late 20s, people were talking about climate change. And then in the 1990s, Al Gore, the much mocked Al Gore, had a really powerful film of what is going on in the climate. And like leaders at the time, one of the first things Ronald Reagan did was he took the solar panels off the White House. That, ceded the industry to like China and other countries, and same with wind. And
Willem, I got you. We got some background noise there, but I think the point taken. Jeremiah, Willem worried that the warnings were there for a long time and unheeded, or I guess only partially heeded. What do you think about the roads not traveled that Willem sees?
I mean, yeah, the discussion of climate change has been around for a very long time. Scientists have been talking about global climate change for many decades. It does seem like in American public discourse that it really only became a popular problem, meaning a lot of people became aware of it maybe only about 10 to 20 years ago, somewhere in that time frame. I think Al Gore's documentary did have quite a bit to do with raising awareness of it, which I think was around 2007 or so. It has taken a gradual buildup, and as Brad mentioned earlier, there is a lot of buildup of youthful energy around this. I think that's been a pretty big part of this too, that activists have really gotten energized and are really pushing the ball forward. And I expect that we're actually going to see that much more momentum going forward. I think we're really just at the cusp of getting it a bit more serious and the political salience really taking hold.
Willem, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Mark joins us now in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hello. Two things. The largest contributor to climate effects is the military-industrial complex. They're the largest consumer of fossil fuels. And so unless the climate activists are also anti-war activists, I don't see much happening. Second point, as long as money equals debt, there's never enough money. And the only thing that happens then is greater and greater consumption of the natural environment. Those two things alone are never going to stop the destruction of the environment unless we take them on.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Brad, Mark pointing toward what he sees, I think, as structural as institutional obstacles to taking climate action. What do you think?
Certainly there are institutional, you know, kind of features that make it more difficult. And I think, you know, that it goes to my previous point about needing sustained effort over time. That being said, you know, climate change is a result of something that's baked into the way that we live our lives, or the way that we consume energy. And this is something that has made it very difficult for us to confront. Even when we have people who are aware of the problem and who want to change it, there's still obstacles in place. You know, I think of the referendum in Washington State in 2016, which seemed like a pretty ripe moment for a state to pass a carbon tax, and it didn't carry through, right? Even though it was a popular referendum that bypassed the ability of the legislature to kind of veto it immediately. And so in that case, right, these obstacles are something that we're going to need to contend with in a way that both kind of respects the social side of how it impacts individual lives, as Jeremiah was talking about earlier, and then also recognizes that there are kind of political features that features of our political system that are certainly challenging in terms of producing change.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Brad Mapes-Martins, UW-Stevens Point political scientist, and Jeremiah Bohr, UW-Oshkosh sociologist, looking at climate change, not the science and the nuts and bolts of it, but some of the obstacles in our political system and our social system to taking action on it. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeremiah, I understand as a sociologist, you look at sustainability and climate change as they reflect our values, our individual values. Do you see clashes, not just so much as far as political polarization, but, you know, we have values like independence or economic opportunity and things like that. Are those kind of core values for some people outweighing environmental and sustainability values?
To some extent, yes. I do think that that is at play, especially when we drill down to this, the level of individuals, to the extent that climate policy is going to be interpreted as this is putting limits on my lifestyle, on my consumer freedom, things like that. I think it is, particularly in the American context, perhaps others too, but I do think that that is one obstacle that that has to be met. And again, I think when we look at some of the age divides in public opinion, younger people seem to approach that obstacle a little bit differently than some older generations do. So I think it does play out differently in different parts of our demographics, but absolutely that is absolutely a one big obstacle.
Brad, when it comes to election time, I think a lot of people may be concerned about climate change, but it never seems to emerge as the hottest issue that politicians are talking about. Maybe, I don't know, that might be the fault of the media in the issues we talk about. I don't know. Why do you think that climate change hasn't been as hot an election day issue, and at least in many elections?
Well, I think one of the main reasons we see this is that kind of more immediate concerns can take over. I mean, if we look back at levels of concern about climate change going back, you know, approximately 15 or 20 years, we see that during, for instance, the 2008, you know, 2009 kind of financial crisis and the recession that followed, levels of concern dropped about climate change, even though there's no intrinsic reason why that should be. We can be concerned about two different things, right? And it's in part just the immediacy of some issues takes over. And that may be a result of media coverage. I know that, you know, one of the kind of areas of research in political science that I've engaged in is how complicated it is for media to portray climate change in a way that is sort of engaging to an audience and also not kind of further entrench the polarization of the issue.
Jeremiah, I want to take us back to our starting point here. You were talking about signs, at least in your social media data set, that polarization may be decreasing. What would you be watching for next to see if that is in fact true and if it results in further action?
Well, ultimately, it's only going to be useful if it translates into votes. And we have not seen that yet. And so just to recognize the elephant in the room, political polarization, partisan cues, things like that, that is the number one obstacle, in my opinion, in our political system to addressing climate change. And the optimistic side of me notes that where my study begins in 2015, 2016, politicians are arguing with each other about the science to a greater degree than they are today. And so there does seem to be, in terms of the debate, there's I don't know if I'd call it a consensus yet, but it's at least we're not as far apart in how we talk about it as we used to be. And I can compare this with other issues like abortion or gun rights, immigration. Climate change is far less polarizing today than those other issues and how our politicians talk about it on social media. That's the optimism, but at what point does that mean that we can translate that into votes? That's tricky. I think it ultimately means that we have to get people seeing themselves as benefiting from the policies that get proposed. And that's much easier said than done. And as I mentioned earlier, I do think that there's been some real intentional citing of the benefits in the Inflation Reduction Act. It seems like they are really targeting some conservative parts of the country to try to bring them into some of the economic benefits that we're trying out with the IRA.
And we'll leave it there. Jeremiah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Brad, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Brad Mapes-Martins is Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Stevens Point. Jeremiah Bohr, Associate Professor of Sociology at UW-Oshkosh, with us today to talk about the social, political, and economic barriers we face in tackling climate change. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, from the front office to the front counter, many businesses use non-compete agreements to limit employees' ability to get jobs at other companies. Find out about a move to limit that. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Could you take on Milwaukee Bucks superstar Giannis Antetokounmpo in a one-on-one matchup? I couldn't. You probably couldn't either. But Giannis has met his match, and it's legendary baseball star Hank Aaron. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel just finished a bracket-style competition where readers could vote to pick the greatest Wisconsin athlete of all time. The initial 32 athletes came from pro, college, and Olympic sports. A lot of different types of athletics were in the mix, though, no surprise. Packers, Badgers, Bucks, and Brewers were heavily represented. The final came down to Giannis against the late Hank Aaron. With 14 years in Milwaukee baseball between the Braves and the Brewers and an incredible number of home runs, number two on the all-time list, and he played before the steroid era. Let's not forget a season with the Eau Claire Bears in the minor leagues, as we've talked about on the show. That's basketball and baseball. Where's the football? We had two football greats, Badgers legend J.J. Watt and Packers quarterback Bart Starr. Check out the full bracket at jsonline.com. Sports legend news you can use. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a former Wisconsin teacher turned policy researcher about the increasing number of emergency teaching licenses that have been issued here in the state. Now, it's not science fiction or a cause for panic, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning that a fungus known as C. auris is spreading at an alarming rate. Short for Candida auris, C. auris has an estimated fatality rate between 30% and 53% for people who suffer an invasive infection. That's according to the World Health Organization. It's generally not considered a threat to healthy people. C. auris is difficult to diagnose. It's resistant to antifungal drugs, and the CDC is sounding the alarm because of the rapid rise and spread of cases in healthcare facilities across the U.S. where it was first detected in 2016. Dr. David Andes is a UW Health Infectious Disease Physician and Division Chief for Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Andes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We have this warning from the CDC. Who should be most worried about this? Who in particular is taking action to try to stop the spread of this C. auris?
Primarily healthcare institutions need to be aware of this, on the lookout for this in their patients. As you mentioned, not really something that the general public needs to worry about.
What do healthcare facilities do with a warning like this from the CDC? Obviously, I assume they're watching for a number of potential contaminants for vulnerable patients. What does this ask them to do now?
This asks them to be aware that this is an infection that is spreading. Be aware of how to diagnose the infection, and once identified in an institution, be prepared to prevent it from being transmitted to other patients, and be aware of how to treat it in the patients that they do identify.
I understand that this is a fungus that's resistant to a lot of our toolkit, or a lot of our antifungal toolkit. Can you talk about the difficulty in treating it and slowing its spread?
You're right. We really only have three medications that work against fungi in general. This particular fungus is typically resistant to at least two of these. So we really only have one medication that works, and the CDC unfortunately found that the rate of resistance to this remaining antifungal has tripled just over the last couple of years.
And that brings me to some research you've worked on over the years, trying to find a new antifungal compound. How do we do that?
Right. As I mentioned, there are only three antifungals we have available to treat us. So we're looking for new antifungals as natural products produced actually by bacteria that are colonizing insects.
Can you talk about some of what you and your team have found and worked on and the hopes that it could lead to development of something that we can use in clinical settings?
Sure. We found a large number of new antibiotics and antifungals that seem to have novel or new mechanisms of action. And fortunately, thus far, activity against many of these emerging resistant pathogens.
And what kind of testing do you have to go through when you locate a candidate, something that might help with fungi in the future? What does it take to get from there to the clinic?
Well, in short, it takes a lot. You have to undergo a lot of safety testing and efficacy testing in patients. So, many of the new compounds that we've identified, unfortunately, probably won't make it to patients for several years.
Now, with this CDC warning for people who work in healthcare settings, maybe nursing homes, where can they go for information about something like this C. auris fungus and what they should be doing in their clinics and other settings?
Probably the best source of information is, in fact, the CDC. CDC.gov has really clear information for clinicians and infection control practitioners on identification, treatment, and prevention of transmission, which is particularly critical for this fungus.
Dr. Andes, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. David Andes, a UW Health Infectious Disease Physician and Division Chief for Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at the CDC's warning about the rapid spread of the potentially fatal fungus known as C. auris. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison chef who's a semifinalist for a James Beard Award this year.
It's 1 hour before the restaurant opens, and the small kitchen inside Madison's Ahan is buzzing. Water is boiling, chicken is roasting, and dumplings are frying. Before they even begin taking orders for the lunch rush, the chefs are preparing two big catering orders.
So today it's 3 Lao egg rolls, 3 vegetable egg rolls, and 3 orders of wontons, a couple orders of dumplings, a couple orders of summer rolls.
That's Jamie Huang, co-owner and executive chef of Ahan.
Well, the word Ahan actually just means food, and I just like wanted it to be something cute and playful, and Lao is my first language, so I just thought it'd be like cute to be like, this is our restaurant food.
Ahan began as a food truck, but quick success made it clear that Huang and her partner needed something bigger. They took a leap and opened the brick-and-mortar restaurant in August 2020, the height of the pandemic. At a time when restaurants were folding left and right, Ahan blossomed.
Yeah, a lot of people, like, when they would pick up food, they were really happy, like, that there was something new that they could look forward to or something comforting, you know?
Huang calls Ahan's food comfort food. And at the heart of it is her mother, Manola Huang.
Earliest food memories? Probably her making papaya salad, like a mortar and pestle in the mornings, making sticky rice, like the smell of sticky rice early in the mornings.
And I make papaya too. She said, Mom, I like to eat papaya too. I say,
That's Manola Huang, who grew up in Laos.
And I say, baby, I make a little bit spicy for you. And she like to eat. And I make noodle soup for Mom, I need two hot chili and lamb. And I put lamb and hot chili for Jimmy. Some people young, they don't like to eat hot.
She got her start early.
Uh-huh. And bak chokong Jimmy there.
Oh yeah, I need one tofu, Mom.
Jamie Huang grew up in kitchens. Her family has owned restaurants across Wisconsin, in places like La Crosse, Beaver Dam, and Madison.
When I do the side job in the kitchen, peel the shrimp, she come to peel with me too.
My mom said I started becoming interested in peeling shrimp when I was like 3.
Eventually, Jamie went to culinary school. That led to jobs at some of Madison's hottest restaurants where she received high-end training. Still, she credits her mom, Manola, for being her biggest culinary inspiration.
I think it wasn't always the path I was going to take, but I've been really happy because, you know, I've been able to, like, take some of her recipes and I'll be able to pass them down, like her like khao soi recipes, like from her specific city in Laos called Luang Prabang. It's like a specific soup to her. And she said her grandma taught her mom and her mom taught her, so. Right now I am making a pram long song with chicken, a red curry udon with chicken, and then I'm also gonna put a fried rice on it.
Jamie Huang's affection for her mother's recipes, her love of lime, chili, and cilantro, and her belief in using local seasonal produce is getting her recognized by her peers in the industry. She's a semi-finalist for a James Beard Award as Emerging Chef. The nomination had an immediate impact on her business.
I mean, obviously it's been really crazy busy. Like, it was busy before, but now it's just like next level busy. I think for staff, you know, it's really showed them, you know, all their hard work is really paying off, and I think it's like setting the standard and setting them to teach new staff that comes in and showing them to always be proud of their work and, you know, like anything's possible. Ollie, you can take the rice from over here too. Everything that we've learned from my mom and everything is like, you know, really coming full circle, and like all the hours we put in and stuff, you know, it really just made it feel like super, super like rewarding, you know.
I happy for my daughter do a good job, you know.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new report that finds that the number of emergency teaching licenses issued in Wisconsin has tripled in the last decade. We'll talk to one of the authors of that report. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, the number of emergency teaching licenses issued by Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction has about tripled over the last decade. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. There's been a big increase in the number and geographic distribution of schools where teachers are getting these temporary certifications. Don Kramer is a researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum and lead author of this report. He previously taught high school math for a decade in the Milwaukee area. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. I'm really happy to be here today.
Before we get into the trends over time, can you tell us about these emergency teaching licenses? Why do schools use them in the first place?
Yeah, first off, we call them emergency licenses, and that's sort of a name that people call them, but that's not really what the Department of Public Instruction calls them. They're actually licenses with stipulations, and they're pretty common because sometimes districts get in situations where they just don't have coverage for something. Oftentimes, if a district can't find a candidate with a certification, they'll get an employee with a bachelor's degree and they ask the DPI for an emergency license. Some scenarios where you end up using an emergency license is a teacher from another state moving to Wisconsin, so they have to get the specific requirements for Wisconsin, or perhaps a district is looking for one employee to work in another department, sort of an elementary teacher becoming a reading teacher or a chemistry teacher that's covering a section of biology for a year. So there's lots of different scenarios where you end up having a teacher with an emergency license.
Well, and I understand we have somebody who had one of these licenses on the line with me right now. You were issued one of these licenses for your first year. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I worked for the farm, I was a high school math teacher. And even before that, I was an actuary. And when I switched from actuary to teaching, I got into a certification program for a year. And part of that program was I was teaching and also taking night classes while I got my regular certification. And it's a common situation where people are getting their emergency licenses so they can teach while they're learning.
Now, the new report shows, yes, these have been used all along, but what have we seen over time, over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, our data has been, we looked at data from 2013 to 2022, and at the beginning of that data, we had about 1,000 licenses being issued in Wisconsin. And in the last year of our data, 2022, we had 3,000 licenses being issued. So it grew by threefold. And when we looked at some of the details there, the largest areas of growth tended to be in three different situations: cross-categorical special education, regular education, and elementary middle school education. And those last categories are pretty general licenses for people that are teaching in a elementary school or a middle school. So it's cross-categorical special education and then those two licenses for elementary and middle schools. Those are the biggest areas for growth.
Now, when I hear the beginning and end point, I might say, aha, well, that's got to be COVID-related, right? But when I look at the chart over that 10-year period, a lot of this jump happened before we heard of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. There was no relationship here with COVID. We definitely looked into that because it seems like everything's being affected by COVID in the last couple of years, but this was definitely a decades-long trend.
Are there particular parts of the state or geographic regions that see a lot of this use of emergency teacher certifications?
Not really. When we look at different states, when we look at different schools, sometimes they get categorized as urban, town, suburban, and rural. And we were looking to see if there was a larger emergency license usage in some of those areas than others, and we're really not seeing it. If 40% of all licenses are in urban schools, about 40% of the emergency licenses, 40% of the growth was also happening in urban schools. So we didn't really see any place that was seeing a larger growth than anywhere else. They're all struggling to find teachers right now.
Talking to Don Kramer, researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, lead author of a new report on the use of these contingent teacher certifications, emergency teacher certifications, they're often called, tripling over the last 10 years or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you facing staffing difficulties in your school district, whether you work there, send a kid there, are a kid there? Have you seen a rise in these teacher certifications? Have you used one yourself, like our guest? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don, people might say, okay, we've been using this all along, so why is it a big deal that we're using more of them now? In a way, it seems like I don't know, we're using a Band-Aid for a tourniquet kind of problem, right? There's something bigger going on, and we're kind of filling in with these short-term solutions?
And that's something that we're definitely looking at, too, because these are normal licenses that get used regularly. They have a purpose, but with the large increase, we look to see, are they being used more often? If they're being renewed. And we were noticing that in the last couple of years that about 40% of the licenses in 1 year were going to individuals that in previous years also had licenses, emergency licenses, which made us wonder, are these being used longer term than just a quick fix, and if people are actually using it as a different alternative route for long-term training.
Is this related to, and we've talked on the show about teacher shortages in the past, is this related to bigger challenges when it comes to staffing in schools?
Probably, and I think districts, when they, you know, come across these shortages, then what happens is, you know, they quickly have to find someone, and so these emergency licenses are a good way to find a Band-Aid to a solution. If they can't find a candidate that's going through, you know, a normal school of education training program, then, you know, you can't wait a couple of years for someone to graduate. You end up using an emergency license because you need someone to be in that classroom in the upcoming school year.
And you write in the report about the use of 3-year licenses. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So there's a 3-year license that its specific purpose is if a teacher's already working in a school district and they're licensed for a different subject area, but they want to expand into a new subject area. DPI has it set up so that you can get this 3-year license because they anticipate that it'll take you 3 years to, or at least at most 3 years to get, you know, licensed in another subject area. So, like I was saying before, an elementary school teacher that wants to be a reading teacher, or, you know, someone that's teaching one section of science wanting to do a different high school section of science so that they can take night classes and get that certification for that other subject area.
Let's bring on a caller. Mark is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mark?
Good. Well, I think, you know, when you started looking at when this whole trend started with emergency licenses going up in numbers every single year, and you failed to link that to the consequences of Act 10, I think you're really not being very smart about the whole thing. When you take a look at Act 10, the average teacher lost somewhere in the vicinity of $7,000 of disposable income because they had to immediately start paying for their own healthcare and retirement benefits. And that caused them out of pocket about $7,000. Couple that with the fact that, you know, they may still have unions, but they have to recertify every year. Act 10 created an environment where teachers, you know, the people that were thinking about going into education or thinking about early retirement, jumped on the boat and got out.
I gotcha, Mark. Thanks for the call. Don, the timeline kind of matches up. Do you see any kind of correlation with the passage of Act 10 on public employee unions and this increasing demand for these emergency certified teachers?
We didn't actually see that directly, and it's also hard to tell, you know, if there's lingering results from Act 10. So we didn't see anything like right away in direct relation to it, but I could definitely understand someone thinking that there's long-term issues. I mean, Act 10 also just plays into the role of, you know, people leaving the profession, people not entering the profession, and that pipeline issue is the emergency licenses are part of that pipeline issue.
Thanks a lot for that call. Don, you've done this report. What are you hoping that, you know, school district leaders and others do with this information you've gathered?
I'm hoping that they start realizing, you know, that this, for one thing, that it's a growing situation for everyone. It's not just something localized in their individual districts. And hopefully they start thinking about, well, if people are using this as an alternative way of training teachers, how do we make sure that our incoming teachers are getting fully trained and are getting all the experiences that they really need so that they can be the best teacher workforce that we have in the state?
And are there things you're hoping to see either from the state legislature or the Department of Public Instruction or maybe education schools here in Wisconsin to reflect this changing reality?
I haven't really thought about that. I'm hoping that policymakers just use this information so that they can make wise decisions in the future.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
That's Don Kramer, researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, former teacher himself, as we heard. We talked to him today about his new report on the increasing use of emergency teaching licenses in Wisconsin over the last decade or so. If you've experienced this yourself, if you've used one of these licenses as a teacher, if you work in a school district that's had to rely on these, love to hear your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. Again, that's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Jane Goodall devoted her career to studying chimpanzees and to protecting animal species and their habitats. She joins the show to make the case for hope and action. Also, voting violations are rare in Wisconsin. When they do happen, it usually involves formerly incarcerated people, possibly confused about their voting status. We'll find out who can vote and when. And we're going to talk about creativity, your creativity. What do you do to be creative? Is there something you've made or created that you're proud of? Let us know now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then people often receive aggressive, even invasive medical care toward the end of life, even if they and their families didn't want it. We'll dig into a new investigation on end-of-life care and the tough decisions along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.